I'm arriving in Bath. There it is, gathered together in an intensity of local Bath stone, still pretty much in the second decade of the 21st century, all of a piece. Rising from a river basin, hills all around it, and the countryside enveloping it. It's a model of what a city was in the 18th century when it's first built. It's a model of what a city can be today. Hang on, you might say. Our politics have moved on a bit over the last 300 years. Yet, I think this gracefully ageing city in southwest England has much to teach us. It was built when workers had no say in society, and yet it offers a gold standard for how we might build ordinary housing today. I went to meet Dr. Amy Frost from the Bath Preservation Trust by a row of stone houses in a back street of the city. Amy, if I was a worker in the early 18th century and I'd come to this street, what would I have expected?
I don't think you would have expected this at all, really. I mean, these are 10 stoneworkers' cottages. So they were built in the 1730s for the workers who were quarrying the stone at the stone mines on the southern hills of Bath. And these cottages were purposefully built for those stoneworkers. But what makes them even more important is that they were designed by the architect John Wood the Elder, so the premier architect, so to speak, of Georgian Bath.
And that sounds straight away quite astonishing from today's perspective. You don't expect the very top, the very best architects today to be designing working class housing in British cities.
No, not at all. I mean, it was an extraordinary, really, to have, you know, the top architect in the city building both the greatest addresses and the most humble addresses.
Amy, imagine ourselves back in the 1730s. I mean, a working man's life, a working woman's life, pretty tough to say the least. And I guess conditions even in such handsome houses as these obviously weren't as romantic as one might like to believe.
No, I mean, life was always very hard for anyone that wasn't sort of a member of the elite. But a lot of these workers would have been working and living in wooden huts around the quarry. These must have been like palaces.
Palaces for the people, it's a lovely thought.
And
300 years on, one delighted new resident let us have a look inside.
Yeah, they're charming, and the finials on top and all the rest of it, it's so pretty.
And it's handsome, classical proportions, properly proportioned rooms.
Well, exactly.
Big windows.
And they haven't been knocked around, you see.
And it shows that that attention to proportion and detail and design is applied in all of these houses, not just the Circus or the Royal Crescent.
Isn't it remarkable? Amy, it's a modest house, and yet it feels grand.
Big. Yeah, it feels big. We're here in the hallway, and you expect the hallway of a small house to be dark and dingy and tiny, especially when they're referred to as cottages. But this is flooded with light.
Today, Britain is a far more democratic society, yet we don't create integrated new cities like Bath. We create sprawl. In this series so far, I've looked, listened, travelled and seen what's going on now. Those responsible for our architecture, planners, developers, politicians and architects themselves, now often say the right things, and there are signs of positive change. And yet so much of what we build is still disappointing. The past is like a ghost, haunting us with the beauty and order of medieval market towns and Georgian streets and squares. Bath was built by a few private individuals on their own terms. So is the lesson that you have to have some kind of top-down vision and control? I put this to one of our top architects, Sir Terry Farrell, who is leading a review of contemporary British architecture for the government.
Control from the top won't achieve it. I think we live in a place of choice, whether it's through democratic processes or in China through market processes. If you look back at the age of Bath and Edinburgh Newtown, the populations were minuscule by comparison with today. And what's more, everyone's wealthy by comparison with the agricultural society we lived in then. And so everyone's building and expecting a home or a flat. I think that the ephemeral and the less worthy tends to go first. And so our view of the past is always a slightly rosier one than probably it should be.
Certainly, at least since the 1960s, one of the big fears has been having building imposed on you. Even in Bath, just round the corner from the Georgian splendours of the Royal Crescent, you can find cheap, hurried, badly designed council housing made not of Bath stone, but Bath concrete. So I can understand why Terry Farrell suggests we must make progress through choice. And while some people find the level of dispute and distrust involved in local developments frustrating, this, says the planning minister Nick Bowles, is democracy.
That's the system working, is that, you know, we elect a local government, but that doesn't mean any more than it means when we elect a national government that we entirely believe or trust that they're doing things in our interests. And there's a huge clash of views, and that there are public meetings, and that there are objections, and that there are people going to hearings, and there's a lot of rows and a lot of noise, and that is in fact a democratic planning process. What would be troubling was if we had a planning process which, to some extent, I think the last government, you know, got close to at least wanting, where there was much less room for all of that kind of noise. And now the noise is often directed at me, so you might think I was in the business of trying to limit it, but actually I don't. I think it's vitally important, and I think the only way that we will ever build enough while hanging on to what's so wonderful about this country is if that process is maintained, and if anything built up, which is why we've, you know, brought in this idea of neighbourhood plans, which makes planning even more local.
Under the Coalition's Localism Act, communities can draw up these neighbourhood plans to say where they think new houses, businesses or shops should go and what they should look like, provided the plan is in line with national planning policy and the local authority's strategic vision. And the new national planning policy framework encourages neighbourhood and council planners alike to require good design. So is this approach the way of ensuring intelligent architecture in a democracy? Labour Shadow Planning Minister Roberta Blackman-Woods.
Planning hasn't taken enough account of design and how you get good quality design. So I was quite pleased that the NPPF that's been brought in by this government, the National Planning Policy Framework, actually says something about design. But you can't just put it in a policy statement. You have to assist local government to really bring forward better quality buildings, and they need to be facilitated in that, they need to be encouraged to do that.
The Localism Act also requires developers to consult local communities before submitting planning applications for certain developments. Mark Clare is the chief executive of Barrett Homes and says the government's localism agenda has helped him change the company's approach.
I think localism then started to drive this whole consultation agenda. We picked up on that very early, and in fact, we actually build for local people. So why would we build things that local people are uncomfortable with up front? We have an absolute role to play to get it right locally. I mean, all our employees are local. Most of our material suppliers is local. All our buyers are local. So absolutely, talking to local people before we've laid the first brick is absolutely critical. And then that started to change the way we thought about engaging with local authorities and with planners. And of course, what we started to see was actually the planning process started to get easier. We were winning more than we were losing. We were seeing timescales reducing.
But Alex Morton of the centre-right think tank Policy Exchange thinks localism and neighbourhood plans don't go far enough, and that council power should be pushed back and local people given the final say.
There are something called neighbourhood plans, which are an improvement, where you can have a sub-local authority little plan. The problem is that they're very long, very complicated. They're almost invariably drawn up by people who are or were planners or architects, and you have one shot at them, and if you don't approve the plan that someone else has sort of drawn up for you, then the council gets power back anyway.
We'll have to see how much improvement localism and neighbourhood plans will make over the next few years. I wonder, though, if there's another way to give political power over architecture to local communities and their local political representatives.
It'll take until after the turn of the century to pay off the loan that was raised to build the flats in the first place.
In our first programme, we explored the way architects have lost control over the building process in recent decades. Perhaps the most spectacular fall from power was that of the local authority architect. Yet once they were a power in the land, designing vast swathes of housing and thousands of the schools that went with them. Sadly, many of these post-war buildings were thrown up in a hurry or on the cheap.
2 hours before the explosion, about 1,000 people evacuated homes in the square mile surrounding the flats.
And so eventually their poor quality, along with such vexed issues as cost overruns and a widespread suspicion of modern design, saw the very idea of state architecture first condemned and then almost entirely demolished, along with some of the worst buildings. Almost, but not quite. One local authority is still creating new buildings for itself. In the summer, I went to meet Steve Clough, Assistant Director of Property Services, and Bob Walbridge, Strategic Manager Design and Implementation of Hampshire County Council, on the site of one of their new schools. Steve told me how their department had moved away radically from the discredited models of the post-war years.
Right through most of the 60s, when the baby boom arrived in that time, there were a huge number of school places required, and the solution at that time was to turn to a system building so that every school on every site in Hampshire was built to exactly the same blueprint. No understanding of which way it faced, how you got into it, and they were very, very lightweight buildings. So they heated up quickly in the summer, they cooled down very quickly in the winter, they had lots of single glazing in them, so they were not good environments for children to be in. But the most important point to note was that they were identical. They had a manual, sort of 1,000-page manual, this is your school. Now, throughout the late 70s and into the early 80s, there was a big shift away to the point where the very first unique school design for Hampshire County Council was done, probably in about 78, 79.
So under the leadership of the county architect, Colin Stansfield Smith, Hampshire ditched the cheap, rushed uniformity of the 60s. But unlike virtually every other council in the country, they kept the underlying principle of that period, that the council's architects control the whole architectural process. Steve Clough argues that this largely abandoned model has real merit still.
So what's different about Hampshire is that you can see it from start to finish, and we continue to look after the building. If this building needs extended, which we think it will do as more pupils come on stream, we've already worked out where the extension will go, and we'll come back, and probably likely the same architect and the same team will extend this building. So it's about looking after what we already own, and it's part of the way Hampshire works, is that we care for what we build.
Is this a more expensive way of building schools?
It's not a more expensive way of building schools. It compares very favourably to schools that are built all around the country. There's no profit to be made in a project like this. And so all of our time and energy is devoted to make this a great, great building.
Bob, so it's a flow of classrooms, isn't it? You've got one, two, three interconnecting classrooms.
Yeah, so this is for the infant-aged children. But instead of being enclosed in classrooms with high windowsills, we're looking to have open flowing space. So it's not just internally, as you've pointed out, but you can see also there's glazing from floor to ceiling. And then that goes out onto external play areas that are very much seen as part of the learning environment. Generally, we like the classrooms to face south so that they actually look out onto sunlit spaces. And you have north light so that you get the daylight, but not the penetration of the sun into the classroom, which could create overheating. And, you know, we're just looking to achieve a sensible, comfortable environment to learn in. It isn't that difficult to do, but it is surprising that, you know, the number of schools you might go to where these simple ways of looking at creating classrooms isn't followed.
So if this old, almost vanished model has shown that it can do much better than the hurried system building of the 1960s, might it offer a future path to local rather than developer control over the architecture of schools? Well, Hampshire can claim to have won the Royal Institute of British Architects Gold Medal in 1991, usually awarded to globe-trotting star architects. And as it turns out, Steve Clough and his colleagues are now sharing their methods with other authorities.
We're currently helping Reading Borough Council, Surrey County Council, West Sussex County Council design and deliver school projects. You need to be able to commission the private sector to build you the right thing in the first place. So one of our roles we take seriously is to work with other organisations in terms of helping them design the right building in the right location at the right time, and then also helping them deliver it.
This is still based on the private sector architect being hired in. But might national politicians at Westminster support a revival of the county architect as a model for the future? Does it appeal to Labour's shadow planning minister, Roberta Blackmore-Woods?
I'm not sure that we would necessarily go down the route of having the architects in house, but what, for example, local authorities could do is have a local design panel, and they could call on that design panel to judge, particularly big schemes.
Not much enthusiasm for a revival of the county architect then from Labour. What about Eb Vasey, Conservative architecture minister in the coalition?
It's very difficult to mandate from the centre of Whitehall, but I would certainly support councils that wanted to build up their planning departments and put good quality design and architecture at the centre.
Sir Colin Stansfield-Smith was the county architect of Hampshire. He was awarded the Royal Gold Medal for Architecture in 1991, one of the greatest awards in the world, the county architect's department, and that seems to be...
a bygone age, doesn't it?
Yes, a bygone age, but should it be? I mean...
No, it shouldn't.
That was quite a surprise. Let's see if we start seeing the return of county architects. But if they do come back, they clearly need to avoid the often arrogant, top-down approach of their post-war forebears and listen to local people as much as developers are now being told to. And this points to one of the big political issues concerning architects and the so-called community. How much do they have in common? The best way to get an architect to understand what ordinary people want might be to have more ordinary people become architects. Sir Terry Farrell.
I grew up in a council estate in the northeast of England, and that has coloured my whole attitude to being part of what is a middle-class profession, really. To be an architect, though, both my parents and all my teachers didn't think I should be, and they didn't really see that as the right career for me. So I chose it in spite of many, many around me, but I'm glad I did. My art teachers supported me.
What did they think you should be?
Actually, they thought I shouldn't go to Form 6 or go to university, and they thought I wouldn't cope, in the words of my careers master.
Farrell's hostility to top-down architecture clearly stems, as he told me, from his own experience. But, as he admits, he's a rare example of a working-class child rising to the top of his profession. Why? Partly because it takes a long time to become an architect, and as Professor Alex Wright of the University of Bath School of Architecture admits, this has an impact on who applies.
Currently, the average time from starting your architectural education to actually registering as an architect is 9.5 years, which is a very long period to commit to. But I think it therefore does have, I suspect, and I think anyone involved in education is very aware that that can have an impact or an influence on the sort of people you get applying to become architects. And I think everyone in the profession is aware that we need to make, if you like, the profession as accessible as possible to a broader range of people as possible. And at the moment, the way the process works, it's actually as much about the eligibility requirements, having done a specific number of years in practice and in formal academic education, as it is about the competence which you achieve through the routes you might take. So I think there are some kind of thoughts and moves at the moment to try and return to a model where the key thing is the competence to become an architect, and the number of pathways which lead you to that level of competence could be much more varied, much more diverse, and for a lot of people, much more attractive.
Meanwhile, we still have an urgent need to improve our everyday architecture. To me, the best way to design and build successfully is to let a single coherent body of people develop a master plan. In an existing community, this inevitably, and quite rightly, leads into a political minefield. But what if you build a brand new settlement near as few existing homes as possible? Might this way offer the most gain for the least harm? That, to me, is the lesson of Bath, and perhaps also of the garden cities and new towns we built in the 20th century.
It is the second of the new satellite towns, with a planned population of 50,000, modern housing estates and fine airy factories.
We had here some 6,000 acres of practically virgin land, and it did enable the town planner, Mr. Gibbard, complete scope in putting the factories, the shops, the houses in the right areas.
What I find exciting about the Milton Keynes plan is that it doesn't envisage obliterating the countryside with the architect's holiday dreams of paved piazzas and point blocks of flats. It envisages rather the surroundings of ordinary British families.
In recent years, politicians do seem to have warmed once more to the idea of building afresh. It's just that so far, they haven't been very successful in making it happen. Eco-towns, for example, were announced with a great fanfare a decade ago and failed. Professor Sir Peter Hall, the veteran planner, who was involved in assessing eco-town proposals, argues that the mistake was a reluctance to go back to master planning.
Eco-towns were a brilliant idea at the time. What unfortunately went very badly wrong, in my view, is that the government said, whoopee, let's have an open competition, and invited everyone to come in and propose their own ideas. What, of course, then happened was that the great majority of the schemes were private developers. In very many cases, these were schemes that they'd promoted before, that had gone through the planning process before, had been turned down before. So if we do this again, we need to start from a totally different place. And that place is a place we started in the 1960s, when we started a second generation of new towns. You start top down and say, where do we want the new eco towns to be? You then go out and get them designed by development corporations, and you then bring in the private sector to implement the development corporation's plans, Milton Keynes style.
But even given the failure of the EcoTown project, the broader notion of building new towns and garden cities is still on the political agenda. Last year, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, talked of applying the principle of the garden city in areas of high potential growth. His deputy, Nick Clegg, has declared that the government wants to create big new settled communities, the garden cities of the 21st century, specifically as a way to stop suburban sprawl and sidestep planning disputes. Yet, like the eco-towns, little has actually happened. And the planning minister, Nick Bowles, doesn't see brand new settlements as the only means to create better everyday architecture.
I'm a great fan of the garden cities. I think Letchworth is one of the great places. But I think that the way that actually to deliver results is through small scale. It's through neighbourhood stuff. It's through neighbourhood planning. It's through self-build. It's through bringing forward that little site that five people through a community land trust can go and build houses for themselves. That's the way actually we will build better things, more interesting things, things that people in the community already will support rather than oppose.
And in recent weeks, the Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, declared that to meet its ambitious house-building targets, a future Labour government would have to build new towns. Meanwhile, Shadow Planning Minister, Roberta Blackman-Woods, isn't mourning the eco-towns. Labour, she told me, is anxious to place the onus on local rather than national plans.
We really want to get away from that top-down approach. We know that local authorities will have to make an assessment of what it is they need locally in terms of new housing and everything else that goes with that. And we want to have a very grown-up conversation with local government, which is you have to now plan to deliver to meet that housing need and everything that goes with it, as well as your economic development plans and everything else. And that could include them coming forward with a new town extension or a number of local authorities getting together and deciding that they want a new town. We would like to incentivise that if that was the solution that the local authority came up with their local communities. But what we don't want to do is to say there shall be 12 eco towns and they should be here, here, here and here, because we really don't think that's the way you get the best out of planning or the best out of architecture or design or the best in terms of just making communities work well.
We'll have to wait and see if either government or opposition plans ever actually come to fruition. Meanwhile, unlike the politicians, I think a top-down approach could work, providing it embraced wider views and didn't tip into arrogance. Perhaps it's time to think radically. Even new towns were somewhat limited. Many were created to rehouse workers from overcrowded slums. Cities, though, take their character, their energy, and even their grandeur from being places for everyone. So what if, like the builders of Bath, we made ourselves a new city? let's go on one final expedition, a quest for a lost vision of the future. I'm walking along a narrow, muddy path. Railings either side, barbed wire, and a canopy of trees, and legions of stinging nettles all around me. This path skirts an enormous quarry in Nuneaton in the Midlands. And what's behind those fences, those nettles, that barbed wire, and down in the quarry deep below is a forgotten landscape in which once a city of a million people, was proposed.
A high-density, low-rise city of a million people. No wasted space, no dereliction, no dead areas, no spoiling of farmland, no class barriers, no pollution, no lack of fun.
It was an invention from the early 1970s. It was an invention of a man called Hubert de Cronin Hastings, the editor-in-chief of the Architectural Review magazine. And the proposal was to create this city called Sevilla that would rise like a modern Italian hill town out of this enormous quarry. There would be lakes, there'd be a university, the houses would be juxtaposed cheek by jowl with schools, with pubs, with hospitals, with offices, with museums, with places to meet. The cars would go underneath. There'd be easy transport links by canal, which is here, by railway, which is here, by motorway, which, of course, was being built here at the time too. Sevilla was a brilliant idea, a real solution to sprawl. It would have been rather beautiful. Perhaps the basic problem here is that politics is short, architecture is long. Politics is fast, architecture takes time. And it can either grow more beautiful and beloved or stick out as an eyesore for decades. We don't spend as much on architecture in real terms as we did when we built Bath, an entire new city for artisans and aristocrats and the aspiring classes in between. Architecture was once the most expensive thing we did. The idea of creating new cities needs bringing up to date. And yet, as we try to build more, as we have to build more, let's aim high, containing sprawl, nurturing our countryside, reviving the city, and build as beautifully and intelligently as we can, with and for everyone.
The Politics of Architecture was presented by Jonathan Glancy, the reader was Stephen Toussaint, and the programme was produced by Phil Tinline.